Hello, good morning, everybody. Great to see you all here. You guys must be really excited about line of business applications on top of Universe Labs to get up that early, 8:30. We really appreciate that. Welcome to our session. My name is Max Knorr. I'm a senior program manager in the DX team, in the TED Technical Evangelism and Development team. What we're doing, both of us, is we're working with global ISV partners, and we're giving them advice on architectures and on how to implement Azure and Windows Universal Apps. And in that case, we're going to present you a bunch of learnings. We will share these learnings with you, learnings that we've got with some of our projects.
Cool, yeah. And my name is Marius Booster. I'm working in the same team, just a different subgroup, I'd say. My focus is a little bit more on the Azure side of the house, so I'd say 90% of my time I spent with Azure. But we worked on a project together, and many of the practices that we are sharing today here in this session are from that project with one of the bigger global partners from Mats, where we also coded a lot inside of a fairly complex and comprehensive universal line of business app for that partner.
So just to make sure we're all aligned on the goals. So the plan is to help you understand the value of composite universal apps, what composite universal apps is, and why it's valuable to build them. And we want to show you the architecture and patterns for building such composite universal apps as well as other complex universal apps in the context of line of business applications. So just a short question. Who in the room is already working on universal apps? Okay, 5-6 people are. Who is building line of business applications? Everybody seems, almost everybody is. So that's a good starting point. So we'll give you a lot of real-world coding samples. We'll show some samples here, and we also have source code available up on GitHub that you can use for your projects after the session if you're interested.
I'm curious about one additional question. Who has ever built a Windows 8 or 8.1 or Windows Phone 8.something app? Okay, at least. Okay. More than half of the crowd,
I'd say. And the last question. Model, view model. Does that ring a bell? Perfect. Okay. Because we're not going to go into the basics of model, view model, obviously, but rather we'll build on top of that.
Perfect.
Cool. Let's get into the first topic and talk a little bit about the value of composite line of business applications.
Wait. I think we should switch to your machine. Here we go. 5. To do that.
So.
Whoops. Here we go.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the value of composite applications. So what is it and how do we think about it? What are the characteristics and what are the advantages? When I think about such architectural principles, and a composite app is really an architectural principle in my opinion, and when I need to explain these things to development teams that we are working with, then I'm always tend to use some sort of metaphor that makes it kind of real, because we are always working in this virtual world where nothing is touchable at the end of the day. Well, touchable. Things are touchable, yeah. And the metaphor that, in my opinion, fits very well to a composite application is a hi-fi system, which is made up of components. In a hi-fi system, you really have modules which are stitched together. So you can have the amplifier and the receiver, and then you purchase additional modules which you just connect together. So these modules are really pluggable, and they are communicating in a loosely coupled fashion with each other. And since this whole module orientation is applied to hi-fi systems, I can exchange modules without affecting other modules because it's modular, because it's communicating in a loosely coupled way based on standardized interfaces. So this is, in my opinion, really a perfect example of a modular application. And it's also an exciting thing. So I like these kind of things more than cars at the end of the day, but that's a very, very emotional thing. These are the basic technical characteristics. But the other thing when you look at these hi-fi systems is that they are very consistent when it comes to user experience. So the basic notion, the basic pattern of how you use them and how you interact with them is always the same. And there are two main reasons why that's the case. First, in many of the new hi-fi systems, you can control a lot from the main amplifier and receiver as your main shell, if you want so, and you can remote control the other modules to a certain extent. Not completely, but to a certain extent. And the other thing is that all of these modules are embracing the same user experience style. And even if I purchase modules from different vendors, I use them in the very same way. I don't need to learn everything from scratch. When I compare that to IT and to user interface applications in our world, if I talk to my girlfriend, she will confirm that it's very different in our world sometimes. And composite applications also in our world are addressing exactly those challenges and those goals that we want to achieve for a more common and pluggable user interface architecture. So, apart from the technical characteristics, we have experienced that in a global development project with a global ISV where developers were spread all around the world. So the way how we did set up the project is we had a kickoff in Vienna back in February of about 1.5 weeks where we did set up the basic solution structure, but then everyone went back to his hometown. So we have people in Germany, we have people in Hungary, we have people in Austria, and then we had us, we are essentially living in the plane. So we were all spread over the planet. And the pattern of composition helped us to really support this distributed development. Since we separated responsibilities on a per module basis after we built that foundational infrastructure in the first week, then everyone was working on his modules in parallel. So the responsibility was clear, but at the same time, due to the loosely coupled fashion of those modules and due to the separation, we could easily, or we did work easily in parallel without getting merge conflicts every day when we checked in our code, because we worked on isolated pieces of that overall composite architecture. So that really supported also simultaneous parallel development at the end of the day. And finally, when you look at our composite application, which we will show a demo in a couple of seconds.
Yeah, it won't be the real application.
It's not the real application.
Once you see it, you will know it's not the real one.
But it's at least one that we can share with you, and it's already on a GitHub account that we specifically created as a result of that session, so that you can have all the principles, source code samples, and everything available. And when you look at this application and you look at the modules, they all look the same. They all look exactly the same. So if we had one or two of our developers had to jump off to another project, so we essentially lost them for our team, it was fairly easy for us to take over their modules because they were all the same. They did do different things, but they were structured the same way. And that's another thing that we really like with this kind of composite applications.
Perfect. So with that, let's go into the high-level architecture at first. I think everybody knows the high-level architecture of a WinRT or a universal app, as we're saying right now. We've got views on the top. Then we have the view models that encapsulate logic to views. And underneath, there's UI services, UI logic components that we're using. So we're keeping that same structure also in our project here. But then we've got this green thing here, common infrastructure. So that's stuff we're using across all parts of the application, such as reusable controls and other things. And to get data, we've got service agents employ service agents that reach out to web services, for instance, and get from a web API REST service, for instance, the data to put it into the UI and map it to a few models. And then on the other side, we have local storage, like SQLite, for instance, SQLite, SQLite, which is wrapped up in repositories. So the interesting thing from that here is that in our application, we decided to chop it, to cut it apart, cut it into modules. So each and every module, as you can see, has its own views. Each module has its own view models. Each module has its UI services. And the modules are vertically sliced. So the modules are per business case, for instance. We'll have a funny business case later on, but in reality, we use that for a flight management solution of a major airline software provider. And they've got multiple modules where one module is the passenger module, another module is the food module, another module is the crew module, another is the video module. And those modules, they are all self-contained. They have their own views, view models, and so on. And with that, you get the benefits that Mario just described. So you can say, hey, I want to ship just the video module and the crew module, but not the food module. I'm not sure I wouldn't want to be on that airlines where there's no food model, but still it's some good idea. Yeah, there's a question. Sorry.
Did you end up with a module called Common?
The question is there a module called Common? And reality is yes, it's called Z on that slide, as you can see. So yeah, obviously you've got some experience in module slicing yourself and you realize what the issue is. So you always end up with some shared functionality. And in our case, that was the service agents because the modules were fairly, well, although we're preaching loosely coupling here, the modules were coupled to each other with the services. So the services were not clearly sliced because the services existed already, so we had to keep the services. So we ended up with kind of horizontal service agents and database repositories. And that's why we put them into a separate module, module Z, which is like a shared common module like you suggested. Yeah, so the question, or actually more the suggestion is, if you're having reusable view models, for instance, like a product that comes in different flavors, could you use that as well? Yeah, definitely. You could put it either into the module Z or put it into the common infrastructure. That's something else that we did. So we have, for instance, reusable controls, as you will see.
But in the real application, we had a shared library that was used by many modules.
Right.
And that was one of the things that we built out and shaped in this first kickoff weeks that we had for the project.
So I think it really depends on the degree of coupling that you want to get. You can decide you want to put it in a separate shared module, like the Z module here, or do you want to just keep it in a shared class library that you reuse across your projects?
And the decision how that airline IT company wanted to split up things into modules was really driven by product configurations, because they were not using that app just for themselves. They also sell it to IT companies of daughter airlines, which they have.
Not even, all kind of airlines
all
can buy
it. All kind
of
airlines, cool.
So it's really about Visual Studio Express, Visual Studio Professional, Visual Studio Ultimate, those different sets of SKUs, if you will, that are being enabled by these modules. That's the biggest advantage.
So was it functional differences, or was it just white labeling? Were they just rebranding?
So the question is, was it functional differences or white labeling? Both. Yeah. But I see you're in that space. Let's have some interesting conversation afterwards. Because we might, you will clearly benefit from some of the stuff that we did. So most interesting here is the few models area, and we already covered, most of you are familiar with few models, so I guess you already know those three frameworks. Is anybody aware of any framework of these three here? Okay, most of you are. So we've got the choice, Caliburn Micro, MVVM Lite, both community-driven, or Prism by Microsoft's Patterns and Practices team. And in reality, we actually built two products with these, with the same company, and we decided to pick different frameworks for both of them. It depends what the team wants to have. Because let's be fair, all of them, all three of them are fairly redundant. So they have, well, the same functionality. So you can pick either of these, and all of the learnings that we have do work with all three of them, to be fair. Yeah, with that, it's maybe time to take a look at the solution quickly. We're not going to launch it, actually, but here's the solution that you can also find up on GitHub. And as you can see, it's a universal app, and here's the overall universal starting project. So we've got a Windows and a Windows Phone project, and we've got some universal shared library in place here. And those three things, we refer them as the shell. So that's the main entry point into the application, the shell. Visual Studio also has a Visual Studio shell, as you know. And then we've got those extension modules, and again, that's not the airlines. As you can figure out, that's more the sample that you can get your hands on GitHub. And it's three modules that we have on offer here. We have a super simple module 1, module 2, and a shared module, as you suggested as well. And then the interesting thing is each module on its own has a repeatable structure, as Mario said. So we always have view models in here. We always have views in here. It's about sheep, in case you didn't. So it could be the food module after all, couldn't it? And it's, well, not here. And it's, again, in the second module, view models.
Depends
and
on
views.
The country.
I don't think that's, yeah, whatever. And here's the shared module, which is slightly different in structure because that's where the agents are in. But you see, the core modules always have view models, views, and then this module entry point that we'll cover later on. So that's the overall structure. As you can see, it's repeatable, it's well-defined, and you always know where to look for something in the module, in the view models folder, and so on.
One tip aside, since we are in the world of universal apps here, we really had to keep them and be very disciplined in terms of keeping them as portable class libraries and not Windows runtime components. Because as soon as you do that, you might not be able to use that modules on other platforms. So they are really all portable class libraries.
As you can see here. Yeah, Windows runtime component is nice in regards of reusing JavaScript or so on, but we didn't really need it. That's why we stayed with plain portable libraries here. Okay, having said that, shall we dig into the model view view model layer and do a quick recap on that one?
Yeah, of course. Let's do that. Can you switch to my machine?
Yes.
So that's kind of the UI patterns we all know and love, and you all know the MVVM pattern and these kind of things and the frameworks that are implementing the things around it. But there are a couple of challenges tied to that, which are especially important to get sorted out for a distributed development team where you don't have direct and immediate control on each and every of your developers at any point in time. And these are the core challenges that we figured out were those that we wanted to get sorted out in that kickoff week. First of all, binding the view to the view model. There are two main approaches out there. That's view model first or view first. So view model first means you instantiate the view model and then the view gets instantiated and displayed and added to the shell. And the other one is the other way around. What we learned in universal apps, so when you're writing Windows Store apps or Xamarin apps, we clearly favor view-first approaches. So why is that? Because WinRT in specific has, or actually all of these app frameworks have this notion of a navigation service really built into the framework. And that navigation service works, guess what, based on views. So it's always instantiating the view for you automatically, depending on the navigation workflow that you decide upon. So we really prefer that approach there. And the frameworks such as Caliber and Micro support mostly both of those patterns. So Caliber supports view first and view model first. Prism, for example, only supports view first approaches when it comes to the Prism version for Windows Store apps and Universal apps. And it's exactly for that reason that I've been mentioning. And we're going to dig into a little bit into each of those challenges that we had at the end of the day. So linking the view and the view model, I talked about view first and view model first, and that we are, for at least universal apps, would recommend you to use view first approaches because of these existing navigation services in the universal app framework runtimes. And for the resolution between views and view models, who is doing the hard-coded in the view? So fortunately, nobody. So everyone knows that pattern, I guess. That is a view model locator pattern, which is supported by Caliber and Micro. So that sample is from Caliber in that case, where you can have type mapping configurations that you add or attach to the view model locator. And then you configure those type mappings based on naming conventions. So in that case, all of our views are called blah, 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 view, and all of our view models are called blah, 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 few models. So the suffix at the end of the day counts in that example. And that's exactly what we did, but we were just sticking to view-first approaches in case of universal apps. So going to the next topic, that's more the state management. So when it comes to universal apps and store apps, compared to traditional desktop apps, you have one challenge that you need to take care of, and that's state management and the app lifecycle. Since those apps get suspended automatically by the operating system when you jump to other apps, and when you don't use the app for a time, and then the user starts switching back. So when you do something like this, and you do something like this, and then you do something like this, the Twitter app most probably gets suspended after a certain period of time. When the user, of course, comes back, his expectation is that all the forms and everything is still filled out. And the universal apps runtimes are coming with the state-back mechanisms. Like, for example, when you create a new project out of Visual Studio, file new universal app or file new Windows Store app, file new Windows Phone app, it ships with classes that allow you to put state into, which get persisted when the app suspends and which gets restored when the app gets restored at the end of the day. One big mistake, and that's the key takeaway of this message here, is one big mistake that we are seeing out there is that people really treating those state packs as a stateful thing and putting everything in there, eventually references to delegates and methods and things like that. That's not a good idea because that gets serialized on disk and gets deserialized from disk. So the way how you really should think when you build these navigation-driven universal apps for Windows, Windows Phone, or even Xamarin is to think of this state as something like a view state, as we have it in ASP.NET, which all needs to be serializable. It's only there as long as this page exists, and when the page gets destroyed and garbage collected, that state is gone as well, and things like that. So that is the key message here. That we wanted to share as a learning. The next one is iNotify property change. Who loves that? Who implements that day in, day out? Who makes mistakes with that? So here we have a cool tip, and that tip is called Fody. And I think we just jump into the demo and show what it's doing for you.
In case you haven't seen it, what's wrong with that view model? Well, it doesn't end with view model, maybe, but that's a convention. But it's not implementing any iNotify property change, so the developer of that has forgotten to do something. Or even if we would implement iNotify property change, but wouldn't raise and just add the event to it, In this case, it still wouldn't work, right? So we would come back, view would not update, and we would realize, yeah, we have implemented the data binding interface, but we're not firing it. And, well, many people keep forgetting that unless they're really used to XAML for a while, because the same thing is true for Silverlight, the same thing is true for WPF. But if you're a novice to XAML, then you're, well, it takes you a while to find out what's wrong with that. And that's where Fodi comes in case you haven't seen it. So I've just implemented the interface, but I've added a NuGet package. You see here, manage NuGet packages. I've added a NuGet package called Fodi. Property changed.fodi. And by having done that and rebuilding, you see that in my build process here in the output window, suddenly Fodi kicks in and starts evaluating my view models and rewriting them. Fodi is an aspect-oriented programming tool that in your build process changes your code, and it changes it for the better normally. So if we come back, here's the old sheep view model in the disassembler. So that's IL spy, in case you don't know it. We're disassembling the DLL and checking what is inside of the DLL box really. Now we're refreshing the whole thing. As you see, the interface is here, but there's even more. In here, we see, well, compiler-generated properties. That's the usual thing. But here's the magic line. Fodi has added that call to onPropertyChanged. And even that method onPropertyChanged was purely implemented by Fodi. So now in my view model, all I have to do is just implement that interface. I don't need to fire any events, any updates. That's all happening automatically by Fodi interception. And the two options are either implement that interface, or the other one, if you're not a fan of interfaces, which I hope you are, is even more compelling for some people. Just put the implement property changed attribute on top and the outcome will be the same. So Fodi will implement the interface and fire the events on the setter of the properties. So some of you might say, wait, that's dark magic. I already know what's going on in my view models. Yeah, I'm a expert in WPF, XAML, Silverlight, Universal Apps now. I know it. Well, then go ahead and don't use Fodi. But I think generally for the mass of developers, and in our team we had 5 people working on different modules, that gave us some consistency. Because not everybody always remembered, oh yes, I need to fire the events on that property as well, and on that property, and on that property as well. And by just using Fodi, we got some consistency across all our modules. That's why we used it, quite frankly.
So essentially, if you restart a new project, the time to write iNotify property changed event raisings and event handlers is over. So if you restart a new project, iNotify property change is as boring as writing the next yet another data access layer, right? So Fodi does that for you. So here we also, that's not the link, but we have the link to Fodi at the end of the...
No, Fodi is just a NuGet package, so you don't need the link at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Just search for Fodi and property changed in NuGet.
I'm a little bit confused. It's so early in the morning still.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one...
All those parties, huh?
Yeah, take it parties. So the next one that we found as a challenge is reacting to user interface events. Reacting to user interface events without writing any single line of code into Vue models, because we because we don't want to tightly couple our Vue models to single views, especially if we want to support different device sizes where we want to have optimized views for the different form factors at the end of the day. Of course, the experienced XAML developer would say, well, on buttons and things like that, you have this command and command argument property, which you can bind to command implementations. And then frameworks such as Prism or even Caliburn Micro. Caliburn Micro has a better approach. Has another approach, ship with something like an aggregate command or a delegate command, which you can just attach to a property and have an anonymous method bound to this. So for all controls that have this command and command argument property in XAML available, that's super easy. So these are essentially controls that are inherited from button base. But what if you want to react to events in your code that are not command driven or that are provided by controls that do not implement or inherit from button base, like a selection changed event in a list box and things like that. And the approach that we suggest there is that you take a look at the Behaviors SDK. Is it still called Expression Blend Behaviors SDK?
Yeah, it's called the Interactivity SDK and Interaction SDK, to be precise. But there's multiple implementations. So
what they do is, what we have here on the slide, they provide you with a base class which they call Behavior. In that behavior, you can embed the logic, the reusable logic that reacts to any sort of event that you want to react on. And then you just bind it with the Interactivity SDK in a declarative way to the control. That makes that reusable code, that behavior code, testable, and it makes it more reusable across multiple view models. So that's cool. Nevertheless, you would need to implement these sort of things. So Caliburn Micro, for example, has a very elegant way of using the Interactivity SDK in its concept of actions to automatically bind methods in your view model to such events and by implementing that behavior behind the scenes for you. So in case your logic to react to events is not that reusable and you just want to have it directly in a view model, then use the Caliburn Micro Actions concept, which automatically binds methods in your view model in a declarative way to such interactivity properties. So cool, with that we are jumping to the next topic, which is modularity in universal apps.
Definitely. So let's step back from the UI, from view model related stuff. Now it's about modules in your application. And you might ask, why do we even need the modules or how can we do them? Because we know WinRT is, well, kind of hardwired. You can't really do anything dynamic. So the whole idea is that we decided to have all these loosely coupled components, loosely coupled modules, loosely coupled view models inside of those modules. And to do that, or by doing that, we got clear developer responsibility. For instance, let's take us two. I was working on the more UI-related controls. I was doing a passenger seating control, super nice, where you saw people where they sit in the plane. Unfortunately, we can't demo it today, but it's really nice. Maybe afterwards, if you.
So in case visit, you didn't realize, he's very proud of that control.
Well, yeah. But to build it, I had to go to a database. And Mario, at the same time, was building the database. So obviously, what to do, right? Shall I wait until he finishes the database? Shall I build my own database meanwhile? What's the approach? And with the modularity and the loosely coupled approach, there was an easy solution. We just swapped out the database, the data access module, to a mock, and we just had a mock implementation in place. And we also knew who was responsible for which module and what were the contracts between those modules. So I think that makes the development process a lot easier. And the other thing is, now you can decide, maybe you wouldn't switch out the database module, but maybe you would, as we said, decide which modules should be switched on. Oh, by the way, we forgot, here's some real screenshot of the real structure, as you can see. So as you can see, there's briefing, cabin crew, duty plan, passenger seating control. Anyway, we're not showing it. And then you can always decide which module should be switched on or switched off, or you could even do that. We're in the store world. You could even do that through the store, through in-app purchase. In theory, you can ship all of those modules and then later on let the customer decide, do I want 3 or 4 or 5 modules, and turn them on by in-app purchases through the Windows Store.
So charge for it, which is always a good thing. No, I didn't say that.
Why? Why didn't you say it? Whatever.
I'm not a business guy.
You're not a business guy. Neither am I. But we like earning something. Anyway, and last but not least, it's quite symmetric. Even on that high-level solution structure, you see, oh, there's always a folder for a module. Then there's always two projects for each module. And inside, there's another structure. So each and every module follows the same exact same structure. So if you're starting a new module as a developer, you just follow the existing structure of existing modules. And let's quickly go into the module concept. That's our fake application. Well, that's the application where you get the full source code. It's not airlines, unfortunately. It's animals. But it's almost as exciting, right? So we have a sheep and a cat module. And you can decide whether that's pet or food or whatever the application really does. But it's just sheep and cats, that's it. If we go into AppXAML C#, the main entrance point here, you say AppXAML C# deriving from Caliburn application, because we are in Caliburn micro here. And there's one interesting thing that is, well, there's multiple, but for now, the interesting thing for modules is that module manager here. That's our custom implementation. Go to GitHub, get it, use it. It's only 40 lines of code, so it's not super, super complex. It's more a sample how you could do it. And what we do is essentially we register
so
modules.
Just to step back on that. So modularity is not part of Prism anymore for store apps. It's not part of Caliburn Micro. It's not part of MVVM Lite. We built something, and we share this as a sample with you on this GitHub repository. And you can use it on your own risk.
You're a lawyer. You're not a businessman, huh? No,
I know a couple of lawyers.
Okay. Good to know. And we have a legal header on top. We're not showing it here. But anyway, but the people who know Prism might wonder why we're doing it, because Prism WPF, Prism Silverlight, would provide that module manager out of the box for you, but not Prism for Universal Apps. That's why we rebuild it, if you will. Kind of. Anyway, so you're registering the modules, and as you can see, each module has a name. Each module has a starting class, if you will. That's like the public static void main, the entrance point. That's just module one class in that case. And then there's a dependency tree. So we've got module one, module two, and the shared module. And module one and two both depend on the shared module. So if I take away the shared module, the application will crash, obviously. But I can take away module two, rebuild the whole thing, start the whole application from scratch, and cats are gone, just the sheep is back in, and the application behaves as usual. So there's no dependencies between the modules. Nothing crashed, everything still worked. And this way you can ship another edition of the application that is just the sheep version, if you will. So what happens underneath? Let's quickly go into these module entry points. So here is module one, here is module two. I'm just putting breakpoints and then showing them. And here's the shared module. Let's just hit F5 again. So the module manager resolves the dependency tree and finds out, well, since everybody is relying on the shared module, I'd rather load the shared module first. And that's happening here. And loading the shared module is that special class that we passed in is called the class that implements iModule. In case you're not seeing it, let's zoom in slightly. And that iModule brings an initialize async method. And there we can do all kind of stuff. Let's continue. Here's the second module, the module one. Again, here iModule is implemented and initialize async is called. In our first iteration, we didn't do initialize async. We just did initialize. Be advised, async is always a better approach. We ended up rewriting it to async. And then, last but not least, module two is being initialized, and initialize async is being called. And all those three module entry points have been called, and that's where we spin up all the rest of the module logic, if you will. Cool. Shall we talk about the... Would you like to talk? Should I talk?
I can.
You'll talk about service locator.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There are a couple of other principles that are attached to this modularity. That one of the principles is service location. And here, fortunately, the frameworks do help us a little bit again. So they implement some sort of dependency injection and inversion of control frame functionalities, where you put central services or shared services into a container, and those get automatically resolved by the components that are using those services or having dependencies on those services through the dependency injection and IOC mechanism that ships, for example, with Caliburn Micro. And we use that pattern, that service locator pattern, for both, for the loosely coupled communication between modules, as well as for the loosely coupled communication to common services which are provided by the application foundation. And to really stay loosely coupled, and that requires a big level of discipline again, to really stay loosely coupled even in a user interface client application where we always tend to be in this world of stateful and we have access to all and everything at every point in time, that's not a good idea if you want to stay loosely coupled. So we really applied principles of service orientation for each and every functionality that we provided as part of a module into the application. So strict interface implementation separation, which makes it easy to replace modules with other modules, and also being stateless when it comes to the communication from one module to another one. And the other one, the last one is that we also kind of had to, in Azure, I would say fail resilient failure resilient. So if a module is not there, the other module does not freak out. It just disables some sort of functionality if there is a dependency. But generally, we tried to avoid dependencies between business modules as much as we could. There were just dependencies against the service modules that encapsulated the service agents, some common functionality, and one of that common functionalities is a common shell, which we'll talk about in a second. So let's look at this service registration and location. In the sample application, and I have the same one. I have a cloned version of the sample application.
Clone sheep?
No, that's not a good idea. And I have registered a bunch of additional modules. But when you look at the structure, I have additional kind of infrastructure modules, like, for example, when you look in the shared module, there is an App Insights service which is doing some logging for me, and we are going to talk about that later. The interesting thing is when we go back to the app XAML, that interface indeed is hosted in the main application. We talk about that later. But when we look at the container registration, so the App Insights service gets created here as part of the main application. And then when we go down to the configure method, which is automatically called by the Caliburn Micro application, I'm registering that App Insights service. And there are a couple of other interesting services Max will talk about in a second, like this Hub Metadata service, which is kind of a central shell service. So we are registering them in the container. And then when I go back to the modules, for example, let's pick module 3, which is a module that I developed in the sample application. When we look at the view model here, the farmer's view model, for example, which automatically gets created by the view model locator from Caliburn Micro, which is attached to the container as well. That way, the inversion of control and dependency injection works. Here I have those interfaces, iApp Insights service, for example, and it just gets automatically plugged in by the dependency check mechanism of Caliburn Micro into my module, and I can just use it. I don't know where the implementation sits. That's one important thing. I don't have a hardwired reference to the implementation. I only know the interface, and when it's there, I'm using it. When it's not there, I'm not using it. Okay, in the sample, I'm not failure resilient, but in the real application, we are failure resilient in case of such dependencies. So that's kind of the service location thing that enables the loosely coupled characteristics of a composite application.
So now we're building on the service model, and as Mario already touched on, we're adding additional shell services in that service locator. And by the way, the service locator can be any kind of IOC container. So we're using the Caliburn IOC container, but it could also be the Unity IOC container or whatever is on offer, whatever your preference is. So it all works the same. Now with the shell, what is a shell? We're not talking command line here really, or bash or something. The shell is the common frame, if you will. So it's like a master page in ASP.NET. It's a common UI with placeholders on top. So now we've taken the, well, we need to admit the German version of MSN Finance, but we speak German, apologies. So it's, but it doesn't matter. It's MSN Finance. You can learn a few German words, but as you see, there's three regions defined on the UI, the red, the green, and the violet region. And now in that regions, each and every module can bring their content. And they can say, I want to put something into the green region. I want to put something into the menu bar, into the red region on top. Outlook or Visual Studio. These two applications are doing exactly the same. For those who have ever used VSTO, Visual Studio Tools for Office, there's regions in Outlook that you can use to bring in your content. Or Visual Studio Isolated Shell. All they use exactly the same concept. The shell as a common frame for modules. And what it brings you is a common user experience, because all modules can only influence a small part of the application. They cannot change the background color, they cannot change the overall UI, they can just influence their small little region on the shell UI. And how to access those is through shell services. So shell services and placeholders allow us to hook into the shell from a module without ever accessing the shell class or the XAML directly. For those who are saying that's a bit abstract, let's quickly show how it works. This is our main page. That's the shell.
Nice color.
Nice color, yeah. I picked it to make sure it fits our shirts. Not sure.
Great choice.
yeah, whatever. So we're not on the UI side. In case you didn't realize yet, we're not in a user experience session at all. Please don't hold it, well, don't hold us hostage for it. But as you see, the main page of the whole sheep and cat application is super simple. There's only lime green background and that modular hub in it. That's it. That's the shell. So we have one placeholder in the shell, and that's this modular hub concept. Modular hub, that's not a standard WinRT control, right?
It's also not Caliburn.
Not Caliburn. It's not Prism. It's
something you built.
It's us, yeah. So, yeah, we build it. And as you can see, you can get it from GitHub again, just in case you want. The modular hub derives of bindable hub. Because those of you using the hub control are aware, data binding on the hub, that's fun. So anyway, modular hub derives of bindable hub, and bindable hub derives of hub. So it's just a derived version of the built-in hub control. And what it does is, essentially, it offers data binding. So there's just a data binding logic on here, and that's it, essentially. So we can bind the hub now suddenly to a view model property that is called hub sections. And if we go there to the main page view model, you see here we've got that property, hub section. And we're using FODI, obviously. We're not firing any iNotify property changed events here. Those hub sections are a observable collection of Hub metadata. And Hub metadata is a meta class where we store information how a Hub region should look like for a single module. Below here, in the view model still, we're saying let's use the Hub metadata service to get all Hub sections that all the modules have registered, and let's bind them to the UI.
So that is an example of a shell service which restricts the way how a module developer can customize the shell. And with that, we enforce that the common user experience always remains the same.
iHub metadata service, that's the service. And you see, it's fairly small. There's two things, get all Hub sections or add a Hub section. It's a super simple dictionary underneath the covers here. But what you say is, in AppXAML C#, we are registering a singleton of that. Can you guys in the back still see the font, or shall we turn it on? Is it okay? Sounds good. Okay, it's okay. So you see the iHub metadata service implementation is registered in the IOC container, in the service locator, if you will, as a singleton. So every module gets the same object of that Hub metadata service here. So now when we go into module one, we get the Hub metadata service singleton, and we say, hey, please add a Hub section for me. It shall be called sheep. Its identifier, random ID, is M1, and that here, the last thing, is the name of the content, the name of the user control that is being put in place in the Hub section. So in that case, the sheep list view, that's a random user control, is being put into the content section. If we change that to button, for instance, you quickly see that the application now has a button in the Hub section, you see? Here, it's not particularly nice, but that area was the sheep list view. So let's put that back to sheep list view, control Z, here we go. And you see the other, module, module two, is also using the Hub metadata service. In that case, it's adding a cat section to the same singleton of that class. And then again, back to the main page view model, the same singleton is again being used to bind the Hub sections onto the screen. So it's a super simple concept. I guess everybody here could write it yourselves. It's not highly sophisticated. Underneath the covers, it's just using dictionaries to store the content. But the idea is the loose coupling with the interfaces that makes it a shell service that doesn't give you dependencies on a concrete size or window part of the screen, but rather it's a meta shell service, metadata shell service on top.
And it does not allow module developers to completely crash your shell by mixing things up and doing wrong things in the shell.
Kicking out the Hub control at all or something, that's not possible.
So cool. So that was all about modularity.
Let's talk about database and state management
exactly.
And stuff
so
like that.
So now we are talking about the offline store that we had in our application. So recap, SQLite. Everyone knows about SQLite, hands up. Yeah, okay, half of the people. So it's a little database engine which you can use for offline storing your application. And for Universal App, it's available as an extension SDK, which you can add through the extension manager of Visual Studio. And then there are a bunch of portable libraries available, which you can use in your application. In specific, we wanted to decide between those two, SQLite Net and the MS Open Tech SQLite Portable Library. And at the time when we started the project, we learned that SQLite Net was a Windows runtime component, so it's not really a universal portable library, whereas MS Open Tech was building an SQLite Portable Class Library, which you really can use cross-platform. And that's the reason why we migrated at some point in time to that library, although it's a little bit lower level since it requires you to select star from and things like that, whereas SQLite.net supports some sort of object relational mapping. So that was just a recap. Nevertheless, we never gave other module developers or all the module developers direct access to SQLite. As Max said before, when we started the project, the repository implementation, so the database implementation for the offline storage for the application was not done yet. And we all know developing a data access layer is easy, but it's lots of work, so it requires time. So what we did is, as part of the kickoff week, we defined a module interface for data access, essentially repository pattern, and I was implementing mock repositories, which we plugged into the application directly. And then while all the others were using my mock repositories, I was building the real SQLite database layer based on the MS OpenTech library. The other thing that we decided is that the repositories are returning the models which can be directly used in the view models, as opposed to any kind of entity classes. Nevertheless, since we got existing web APIs with existing proxy classes from the customer, we were tied to some sort of data model which had some caveats. For example, the data model did not have unique identifiers for some of the entities. We just had to deal with that. SQLite requires you to have a unique identifier for your entity. So we ended up at the end of the day writing internal SQLite entities that mock a primary key as an artificial key. We used that to store that in the repository, and we had some manual mapping classes that returned, mapped that to the model classes and returned.
And that's some good advice, because you can also add stuff like a last update date
or
stuff
that's a
like
good
that
point.
For synchronization to these entities in the database separate them.
Good that you remind me, because that's exactly what we have done for the demo that we are sharing with you as part of
the
session. Yes, I have done that. So let's look into the demo. SQLite repository. So the thing that is special when you want to do that as a portable library, and that's one of the key takeaways of that demo, is that you need to make sure to only add the right NuGet packages to the right projects, and don't add too many NuGet packages. So for example, here I have my repository implementation for SQLite. And that only has the MS OpenTech SQLite portable class library piece of it. That's kind of the generic implementation. But then for my concrete app implementations, so when you go down here in the sample that you can clone from GitHub, in the concrete implementation for Windows 8.1, I added an additional SQLite library, which is essentially the platform-specific extension. And that looks different for Windows Phone. I just wanted to say Windows Forms. I guess we are not in a WinForm session. So Windows
Phone
is it
the same for
and
Windows
Forms Store apps. And now comes the cool thing with the OpenTech portable library. That same extension exists for iOS and Android, so you can use it in a Xamarin application as well. And since all of the other libraries are truly portable, you can use them in a Xamarin application and build native apps for iOS and Xamarin Android as well. So that's the first key takeaway here. The second one is the rather simple one, and it shows the approach in action. So when you look at the application right now, when I start my application here on this machine, so that's the app, that's the cats and the sheeps, and here is nothing. So I need to hit synchronize, and then I get some data. And that data is something like this. And if I update this and I hit synchronize, all gets erased again. That's because that's the mock library. So the mock library is essentially here added as a module. So when I go back to my app XAML, so I collapse all that stuff here, go back to the universal app, zoom in a little bit, and go to the module initialization here, I am Shift-Alt-Enter to full screen. I'm here instantiating the mock repository module as opposed to the real repository module. So I just exchange that. Control KU, Control Shift B, Shift Alt Enter. And when I start the thing now, what you'll see is that the repository implementation is directly delivering data which is stored in a local SQLite database. So in our development process, all the people were most of the time developing against the mock repository. Yeah. Since that was also kind of, you didn't have to access the web services of the customer to get the data and things like that. In a build configuration, we just switched the module to the real module when we built the test version for the testers and the production version.
So we actually had a hash if in the code. So instead of commenting stuff in and out, we had a hash if with different build configurations where we could switch, is it with real or with mock repositories? And that also works well.
So, and in this implementation, I really did a loosely coupled fashion. So instead of baking the interface directly in the model, it's in a separate interface library and it has the model here. And then this interface is implemented by my mock farmer repository. Mocking is or repository pattern is a very common pattern, so I guess you know it. And here in the synchronize, I'm just generating some arbitrary test data. I could have used
NBuilder
for that. That would have been easier. But
that's
anyway,
another nice NuGet package that generates test data.
And then the real library is just really going Shift Alt Enter is really using. Like when you look at here, execute query. Execute query is using the portable library from MS OpenText. Yeah. So I have a provision database which creates the database if it doesn't exist. I have an execute query with parameterized things. So it's really like ADO.NET, that whole library. But since it's really hard to find samples on the library, now you have one, so which you can take a look at. So that was kind of repository and mocking. And now we are going to another topic, which is storage.
Unstructured storage, shifting gears from structured SQL storage to unstructured file storage. And again, a little recap. So you're aware that there is three different storage folders. In a Universal App, you can use a local storage. You can use a temporary storage, which is cleaned up at some times. And you can use a roaming storage. And, that's not new. But for us, the important learning was be aware which storage you're using. We mentioned passenger data. Roaming storage is not the best storage for passenger data. Because roaming storage means it's synchronized across multiple devices. And while that is super nice in a consumer application, in a business application, line of business application, most often that's not super nice. So when we said, oh yeah, and by the way, we did code review with the partner, and we said, yeah, this is the line where we store all the passenger documents in the storage. And what they said is, what's that roaming? Does that mean anything? And, oh, yeah, we discussed it through, and turns out we never use roaming storage now in the whole application because it's all PII information that shouldn't be roamed across unless you explicitly do it through the application.
And it happens through the cloud.
Obviously, the roaming happens through some cloud service, which is nice, but be aware if you're using it, what you're doing. That's the takeaway here. And then another little story here, MaxPath. That's not me. But who knows? Who knows MaxPath issue on Windows? A few know, 10 know. Mostly older people, I realize,
everyone is smiling at least.
256 characters. We would have thought that's gone away. Yeah, I see somebody nodding. It's still real. MaxPath is still here. Even in Windows 8.1, it's still a topic. Let's just, instead of showing the slide, you can watch it later on, let's just do a little demo here. The demo goes as such. We download a zip archive from a web service. Not really. We just fake it. We get a zip archive, and then we store it in the temporary folder below here. And then what we do is we start unpacking the zip folder using the zip archive here. And basically, we have this huge, huge zip file, and we unpack it into local storage. Let's just start it up, see what happens. Ooh, path too long exception occurred.
So now we have proven that it's still there.
Reality is, it's really a super long path. You might say, why would somebody want that artificially long path? You say, that's the path. It's kind of fake in that sample that we're sharing with you, but we really learned about it from the partner calling us up saying, I got this path too long exception. What does that mean? So we did research, and turns out it was with the flight manual for the aircraft. An aircraft is super complicated, apparently. It's like 600 megabytes of HTML content in like 1,000 pages structured in subfolders. And they wanted to be that aircraft manual to be displayed in an embedded browser. And after the download, they got that exception. What's the obvious quick solution? Everybody knows what the solution is. Make the path short, right? So, well, you can just shorten it, and you just need to store somewhere. What's the short path, and what was the old long path? Because, unfortunately, it's HTML, so those files know each other. Those HTML files have references to each other, and guess what? They have references to their long names. So you can shorten the names, but somehow you need to keep track of what was the original long name and what's the new short name.
So we could do a search and replace.
Huh? We could do a search. Well, we considered, could we just do a search and replace on the 1,000 HTML files? They said, no, we're not touching the aircraft manual for legal reasons. We cannot change it, otherwise, blah, blah. Okay, turns out it's not as complicated as you would imagine it is. And that's why we want to share that with you, because it's super nice.
Since Windows 8.1.
With WebView. Reality is, here's the shortening code. So we just create a GUID. Sorry, we like Git salespeople here, huh? Everything is Git, Git. We just create a new GUID, sorry. And we store in a dictionary. What's the old file name? What's the new file name? That's super simple. But then how we bring that into our WebView? And there's a nice thing that comes to help. WebView is the embedded browser, in case you don't know.
In a store app.
Universal app. And here's the nice thing. You can write your own URI resolver. And that's super nice. Yeah. So you implement that interface, and you use it on the WebView. And by doing that, every time a navigation happens, the WebView asks you, is that really the URL? Is that the URL? It's like a URL rewriter on the client side. That's super powerful. You see, it gives me my old long URL, and then I do the rewriting to the flat path, and I give back the flat path file. And, well, that's old content. There's still some error in the zip file. It shouldn't say tech ready here. That's our Microsoft secret internal conference, so we shouldn't show that here. Let's quickly close it. Tech it. Again, the roaming storage, maybe. Watch out with the roaming storage. I told you guys, it's super
But anyway, it loaded the image
successfully. But anyway, it loaded the image, and everything worked. So, yeah. Feel free to reuse that sample if you ever occur the same issue. URL to stream resolver.
Cool. Nice tip. So let's go to the next topic. That's insights, app insights. Especially when you run a business application that is used by many users, you want to know when the app crashes, when something does not work in the app, and how the users are using the app. And that's by collecting telemetry about how users are using your application. And we think, especially for business application, that's super important because it helps the team to do bug fixing, identifying issues, but as well as planning the roadmap of the application. Which are the features we need to focus on? Which are the functionalities we need to prioritize? And for that, telemetry is inherently important. And this is one of the last topics that we would like to touch upon. So of course, there are different ways of how to do things. One very pragmatic solution would be to say, oh yeah, there is this thing in Azure called Azure Mobile Services, which is super simple. I could just write my own mobile service and write some logic in the app to collect some data and log some data into a mobile service. That's a perfectly valid approach. And that's definitely one thing that you can do. What we nevertheless did for this application is we leveraged a functionality that is still in preview, but nevertheless, it was so important for the partner that we wanted to have a look at it, and that was Microsoft Application Insights. App Insights is app telemetry as a service, app telemetry and reporting as a service. And you can use it for your web applications, web services that are hosted on servers, essentially for any server application. And in the meantime, there are also NuGet packages and libraries available for store apps and also for universal apps. So, and that is the thing that we wanted to show you in our last little demo. So, when we start our application here, you don't see anything special going on. Whenever we do something, like for example, synchronizing, we are logging how long it took to synchronize the data from the web service that I'm simulating here on localhost, by the way. And that's then hosted or displayed in Microsoft App Insights. At the moment, there are two ways to access App Insights, through the new Azure Preview portal or through the Visual Studio Online portal. The new Azure Preview portal does not include all of the reports yet. That's why we are showing it in Visual Studio Online. So in Visual Studio Online, when you look at this page, don't ignore all these nice fancy images because one of them brings you to App Insights, and that's this here, that blue one here. So when you hit that button, what you see is that I've registered my application in App Insights, and registering means you create an application by hitting this Add button over there. And for some reason, it doesn't let me go up. This Add button, and then it generates some keys for your application. And when I go to usage in specific, what it does is it's tracking usage events of my application. And you can see we had an increase in usage right now today because I was starting the application several times as part of the demos that we have been showing. But even cooler is that we are tracking events. So we have specific events here which are very specific for our application, like farmers, update, sync. Here we have these timed events. Here we have module load events, and here we have search events, which are searching for images and cats. So how have we done that, and how would we recommend to you how you do it in a modular composite application? So the first thing that I did is, since those NuGet package libraries for App Insights are still platform specific, I was unable to use them in my modules because they are written specifically for phone, specifically for Windows Store, specifically for iOS, specifically for Android. So what I did essentially is in my shared module, I defined this interface, iAppInsights, which logs events, errors, and timed events. And App Insights works in a way when you start an event, it returns a context object, which I pass in to stop the timed event tracking. Okay? So now this service is one of the central services which is implemented here in my universal app. Why did I do that? Because I have this library, this NuGet package for Windows Store, and I have the same thing, which is a different NuGet package, although it shares the same namespaces, for Windows Phone, but it's still a different NuGet package, it's still a different compiled library because these libraries are native as they work for WinJS, .NET based, and C++ based store apps and universal apps. So fortunately the namespace references are pretty much the same. So in my universal shared code project, which is this funny guy here, I have the implementation of my App Insights service, which looks like this. Shift, Alt, Enter. iApp Insights is the interface. Here I register my client analytics session with a key that I got from this App Insights portal, which is my telemetry key for store apps. It's not the full key for full access. And then I had to do something. I guess this will become better as soon as the libraries and the service will get in general availability. So I had to say, when I'm in a Windows application, I'm using this API here. You see, client analytics log event, new list of key value pair, and the phone implementation, the phone team, obviously realized that in .NET we have a dictionary and we don't need to do a list of key value pairs for achieving the same goal. I hope this will go away, but at the moment it works like this. But nevertheless, my modules are just using this thing based on an interface, a decoupled interface, and here I'm logging these events into App Insights, and when you look at the usage of it, in one of those modules, for example, my module 3 view model, and I go into the synchronize method here, here I'm logging those events.
It's all agnostic, yeah.
Yeah. So App Insights log start event, and this here, this structure, gives me the hierarchy in the portal. So yeah. These hierarchies. And that's really cool to get some details about your applications.
So guys, it's always the same, right? We're officially at the end of the shipping something here. And we still haven't touched on deployment. There's only one slide left, no worries, but that's quite symptomatic. We never really think about deployment up until the end when we really need to ship. Quick advice, when you do deployment and build, you'll realize NuGet works nice, but not the extension packages. That's the big takeaway here. SQLite extensions, for instance, super complicated to build it, unless you install that little Visual Studio add-in. That's our key takeaway from that slide for you. And please think about building earlier than we did right now here. You should keep some time because it's not super simple, but it is once you have installed that add-in. Having said that, what did we cover? What did we show you? We touched on composite, modular, universal apps that enable you product configurations, parallel development, and repeatable patterns.
We touched on architecture patterns beyond MVVM and the standard things like service locations, repositories, and loosely coupling through service location and IOC in our architecture to enable this composition. And we touched on higher level services, which we suggest that you implement in such composite applications, such as a shell service, which restricts the way how module developers can customize, extend, and plug into the common user experience of a more complex application.
And last but not least, we showed you a lot of demos. We have them up on our GitHub repository. We need to say it again, but we're super proud that we managed to put it up before the session even. First time. Go there, get all the samples, take an extended look back home, and reuse it as much as you like, as is. So it's a sample code. Take it over as a responsibility and, as fun for your own project here. Having said that, thanks a lot for joining us this morning. I hope it was valuable for us. It was definitely fun for us. If you've got any questions.
It was valuable for you.
And fun as well. Did I say valuable for us? Whatever.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. If you've got any questions, join us in the front.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.